So let's start, Ruud. You've been a man of the world, at least of two worlds. You're living in the Netherlands, and you quite often frequent this part of the world. And how would you describe Netherlands?
That's interesting.
So what kind of society?
What kind of society? Well, that's a different way to decide to describe our society. But let's say the first is we are, let's say, the most wealthiest, most happiest, among most freest societies in the world.
It's perfect society. Almost perfect society.
Well, you could say that if it is a perfect society, that would be like a misunderstanding. But because if you are the most freest, happiest, wealthiest society in the world, this creates a whole new set of problems.
Exactly. Yeah.
So this means that... So,
like voting against Ukrainian,
for instance. So that would be a good thing. So you told me about your interest in values, so in value research and the Engelhardt value research, and this value research basically confirms what I said. If you look at the Engelhardt value research and you see this mapping of Engelhardt, you see that in the Netherlands we basically have. You have two things. Our citizens are, let's say, the most critical in a certain sense in the world. And so you want to criticize, you criticize your institutions as a habit, so to say. And on the other hand, one of the most important issues of the society is that you are working on, let's say, on a conscious way of creating more happiness for yourself. So we are also, in that sense, an extremely individualized society. So, so you could see it that way. Huh? So this working on the striving as a value, as a striving for wealth, happiness, and freedom.
It's like a self-expression using the Engelhardt.
Yes,
But also, you're also very secularized.
We're also very secularized. And that's, if you compare these two worlds, that is really one of the most, let's say, most visible things which you see. So in the Netherlands we are, let's say, we are a secular society. So if you look at it, the minority of our citizens really are active believers, going to church, practicing.
Which makes you very different from France, I believe.
Makes us very different from France.
And probably from Belgium as well.
Yes, Belgium is more or less in the same direction. But France, of course, is already different, and Ukraine is already very different in that. And so you see, Ukraine is basically a very religious society. And in the Netherlands, you see that we are basically a very non-religious society. So basically,
if I make a distinction right here, you're still religious, but you're secular. It has a public sense.
Yeah.
You may attend the churches or synagogue on the public, on the private level, but it's not a.
Well, that's basically, it's good to say, but because there's basically these two things. It is one of the practicing of religious. Religion is becoming a very, let's say, private side, so to say. But it also means that in terms of being religious, this is also decreased immensely. So if you have some sociological research in the Netherlands, and so about the meaning of religion for people in daily lives, and they ask the question, are you religious? Do you believe in anything? Well, most people say something like, well, I'm not a regular believer anymore. I don't believe in God, but I believe in something. There must be something like that. So you could say it's a bit nihilistic. So you believe in, it's like a safe way to say there must be something, but it's not religious in the traditional sense. So you don't believe in that. And believe secular means something different too. That secular means basically, and you think about the meaning of Charles Taylor gave it to the meaning of secular.
Say it again.
Charles Taylor.
Charles Taylor.
He wrote a beautiful, very important book about secularization. He said what secularization actually means, that you criticize basically your religion and the doctrines of your religion every time from, let's say, from a scientific point, is it true? From a moral point, does it contribute to a more better world? And from an aesthetic point, so to say, does it create something of value for my personal life? And if it doesn't, then you criticize it. You say, well, okay, then it's not very helpful for me in my life anymore. So that doesn't mean that religion has to disappear, but it is under a continuous critique, so to say. And you could see that in the Netherlands developing from the last, let's say, 7 years after the 50s. And so you see that I studied with Catholic philosophers, so in the 70s, and they all fell off their religion, and that they fell off their religion was part of this, this criticizing this religion from this different point of view.
When would you define, when do you start thinking, or you personally, but also your society, start thinking about itself in that way, in these ways? I believe it's historical. It was not before the war, probably. It was not during the war, after the war. If not the war, when?
If you could define it a bit, like you could, I think, pinpoint it really precise. It started in the 60s.
60s. Basically. So we're talking about the 60s.
Yeah, talking about the 60s.
And this is what I believe. This is presumed. The 60s phenomenon.
Yeah. And then it developed really fast. So it was, and it is, if you look at it from the perspective of history, and history of values, so to say, this and the institutionalizing of values, this is, and this is really a, let's say, a world historical phenomenon, that you really live in a secular society like this. So if you, maybe this is a bit like too simple to produce it this way, but you could see like this way. We have, let's say, starting with Hammurabi and the Ten Commandments already there. So we have, like say, a 2,500 years traditional moral history in most part of the Western world, so to say, and not only the Western world. And it is basically institutionalized as a history of the book, as a history of functionaries, as a history of institutions like a church, so to say, and it's connected with the authority of all three of them. And if you look at this from the perspective of what happened in the 60s and the 70s, this is basically a radical deconstruction of these 2,500 years of normal and moral history, so to say. So this is a really world historical phenomenon, and we're still struggling with that. What it actually means for us as a society, how to respond to that, what it means for you in terms of your own things, conscience, moral judgment, values, identity. And so this creates a whole new set of problems and a new set of opportunities to work on.
Does it make any sense to define your society and set as a postmodern society?
Well, in the sense you could say, if you again go to Engelhardt, he calls it postmodernization. You could also say but the word postmodern is so much loaded, so to say. And so if you look at it from the French perspective, what they mean by postmodern, French philosophers, what they mean by postmodern is like becoming critical in a radical sense.
I would probably make a distinction here. I'm prefer to talk about two things which sounds similar but are a little different. There's postmodern condition, and there's a way of talking about postmodern condition. So there's postmodern condition, there's postmodernism. I'm not talking about the postmodernist as an intellectual condition, intellectual, but this kind of condition.
Yeah. So I would like, so if I think about this, postmodern condition, like Lyotard thinks about this, but much more...
But Lyotard is not the part of postmodernist discourse.
Well, of course, and I think, so you could use some other vocabulary, like Ulrich Beck, a sociologist, differentiate between the first and second modernity, or... and the first modernity is about industrialization, urbanization, and that kind. And then the second modernity is a kind of radical version of that.
It's probably a little bit better than the post-industrial society.
Post-industrial, post-ideological, post-institutional, you could say it like this way. And so, So that's I think would be better. And but if you think about second modernity or even third modernity, you could say that, well, post always said something, there is something you leave behind, and that's true. But it doesn't say that it creates something new and valuable. And I think that we are in creating something new, what is really important, not only for us, but also for the rest of the world. You could see the Netherlands, but also Denmark or Norway and parts of Germany and parts of Belgium as a kind of a laboratory.
I would probably define it as a kind of north of North Protestant Europe,
yes,
more or less.
Yeah, North Protestant, but post-Protestant.
Post-Protestant.
You could say
in terms of historical Protestant,
yes.
Historical country.
So this is this.
So what happened with the in such society? What happened with the identities?
Yes.
Like what has happened? What is historical memory of the Dutch people nowadays?
Well, you could say what. Like we have a beautiful queen, and Maxima. Yeah, so and she's from Argentina, and she married, of course, our King William, and our King William is, let's say, from top to bottom Dutch, so to say, and very much connected with the part of Dutch history being Orange and being Orange in the sense of the House of Orange and so on. And our, let's say, our father of fatherlands is William of Orange, basically created the first moment and was made a co-creator of our war of independence, so to say, so against the Spaniards in the 16th century, started the 80 Years' War. So, and then he married his wife. He was Argentinian. And Maxima was invited to, after she has become, I think, 2 years of a queen in the Netherlands, to comment on Dutch identity. And could you say something that was a question, what is actually the Dutch identity? And to the annoyance of especially right-wing parties, and she said, well, I'm living now for a couple of years here. And to be honest, I don't see one. There is no established Dutch identity anymore. So we have something like a Dutch identity, which you see when it comes to the House of Orange and with the celebrating the King's Day and football and that kind of things.
But you rather refer them to this institution, which is a royal house,
yeah,
than to some kind of the events of your history or some kind of what has cultural phenomenon.
So I think there's something interesting. So identity is always like somehow construed about some vindicative, so fundamental stories, which you refer to as something, as an answer, who am I? So who am I as a Dutchman? And this answer of this question, who am I, is something also giving an answer, so who should I be? Mm-hmm. So it is not only pinpointing who you are, but also what you should do, something like that. And in a certain sense, you could say that this secularization is a kind of phenomenon that deconstructs this, the word of the answer to the question, who am I? Mm-hmm. So you could say in that sense, if you ask me, I'm a Dutchman. So, and who am I as a Dutchman? Well, this is in a certain sense you could answer this question, because what's really, if I look at it, what's really, in a certain sense, decisive of being a Dutchman is this liberal thing. Liberal in terms of classical liberties. So we are very liberal, not liberal in the political sense, but liberal in this deep Renaissance sense,
the
discovery of the of what liberty actually is, liberty of thinking, liberty of judgment, liberty of openly say what you think, and have the liberty to do that. So to say, I think this is one of the most, let's say, constitutive parts of our of being a Dutchman, this liberal thinking, this almost anarchic liberal limited.
But then in what sense should we define yourself different from Brits or from France or from the... Because still it makes a... The problem of think also think about the very being liberals, so to say.
Yeah, yeah. So at that time,
stories, narratives, yes. Narrative must be there.
So that's what I'm a bit like doubting the word liberal in that sense, because it isn't precise enough to pinpoint that. So I think in a certain sense you could say yes, but that counts for all Europeans, so to say. And this part, and in a certain sense it's true. But if you look at it. Now, for instance, in the Netherlands, I would say this liberty is being radicalized, so to say. We are more, in a sense, more radical in the sense of liberty than the French are, or than the Greeks are, or than the Germans are, so to say. And that's...
At the cutting edge?
What's it?
At the cutting edge?
At the cutting edge, you could maybe say so. And so you could say that, and what does this liberty actually do? It puts everything under critique, constantly, even your own identity. And that's what Maxima, I think, recognizes. What you're doing is actually still deconstructing point by point your own identity as a fendicative, as a foundational story. So that is what I see, that being post-identity is something like the identity is not going to answer our future, our question of what I should do in the world. What it does, that it creates me as a subject, as a being, as a human being, but also as a citizen, that you could say, okay, but that means that I have some obligation to work on this liberty of all people in the world who basically face the same question, what can I do, what should I be? So in that sense, you could say something that...
You're answering like a philosopher. I'm asking you as a historian. So I have to feel some kind of flesh. So what will be narratives or personalities, whatever, who do you refer historically in your case mm-hmm. as being Dutch, essentially well, Dutch?
Yes, you could say that. This is also
like a national pantheon.
Yeah.
So national pantheon of heroes.
Yes, our heroes. Well, you could say there are several. So you could say, of course, Willem of Orange would be one of them. So, and then you could say Spinoza is one of them.
It's very good here.
Yeah, you could say, what are the heroes of liberty, so to say. Spinoza could be one of them. But you could also say one of them could be, who was working on this narrative, could be our first historian of the Second World War. He tried to reconstruct that as a good, who basically created something like this historical narrative relating to this war. He's called Lou de Jong, mm-hmm. so to say. So he's one. Johan Cruyff is one. Okay? So if you look at our national hero now, he just died. So Johan Cruyff, you know him, our most soccer player. Mm-hmm. So if you look at him,
it was a month ago.
Yeah, a few months, 2 months ago, I think.
And he was famous in 60s, 70s later.
Well, you could differentiate between his career as a soccer player. So then he was in the 60s, no, the 70s. His career was in the 70s, beginning of the 80s, but he never stopped. So he was a real thinker of football. Mm-hmm. He was a philosopher of football. and he's Johan Cruyff is really, at the same time, he was a thinker, philosopher of football, but for football from the perspective of liberty. You could say it like
it's
that.
Nice. It's very nice.
So you have Johan Cruyff, you have our icons in history is our Queen Wilhelmina after the Second World could be one. So would there be a Thorbecke, our foundational father who created something like our constitution in the 90s. So this is a bit like, I think, but if you would ask people in the Netherlands as a historian, let's say, okay, could you give like, who would be your heroes now? That would be a slightly different list, so to say. So especially Johan Cruyff would be high on that.
Say again?
Johan Cruyff would be high on that.
Soccer player.
Soccer player. But they would also now say Pim Fortuyn, for instance, who was the politician who was killed in the beginning of the century, so to say, as a kind of first one who articulated a bit of the uneasiness in Dutch society.
This was his rightist or not?
Yes, it was his rightist. So, and then we are talking about more like sociological. So, what would people say? What are your heroes, so to say? And because he articulated, he was also like, he was very vain in a sense, but he was also very liberal. He was something like was very, very, let's say, outspoken in what would be our main. As a society, our main constitutional values are, so to say. And it was, of course, we were very much discussing about migration, what you're allowed to say, what aren't you allowed to say, and that kind of things, and discrimination of. And he was very critical, for instance, on Islam.
Funny, but a part of Wilhelm Orange, you don't have any military heroes.
Military heroes. Ah, that's interesting.
You know, yeah,
we are not very militaristic country, so.
We probably have a lucky history. Happy history. Doesn't fight that much.
Well, if you look at our fighting history and our military history, I think the main part of our military history was, of course, the 80 Years' War, and we went military history where we were world power. So, and you could see Michiel de Ruyter was one of our heroes. So we even.
Is he still a hero?
That's interesting question, because what we do with our heroes today is we deconstruct. So there is now actually a discussion about Michiel de Ruyter, because for a long time we saw him as one of our military heroes. He even took a boat on the Thames so to London. And today there's what you can see is that there is we are now a multicultural society, so to say, it's a wrong word, but we are. And our the people who are African Netherlands. African Americans, you have the African Netherlands and Caribbean Netherlands.
This was come from colonists, former colonists?
Yes, who come from the colonists. There's all Africa and then go to the Caribbean and then come to the Netherlands. And so they started criticizing the Ruyter because he was also related to slave trade, for instance. And so that kind of thing. So that's what this radical, what you call postmodern, and this critical, that you create, you deconstruct your own heroes. So we are becoming a country without heroes, so to say.
Is it dangerous way to live? Is it dangerous or is it not?
Well, that's what I say. If you live in that, it creates a kind of society what has some, Hannah Arendt would say it like, you are in a kind of society in a certain sense without precedent. So you have to think about it anew. That's why it's so an interesting country for philosophers and historians, so to say.
Because again, it looks like a history doesn't matter that much. Well, kind of in a historical narrative.
A historical narrative, in the sense that history is still a mirror. So if you look at the story of the Ruyter and the destruction of this history is still a mirror. And we are very much interested in history as a country. But not as, what I always wanted, the difference between, for instance, Ukraine, the role of history in Ukraine, and you compare it with the role of history in the Netherlands. When I read some things about Rushevsky, who's reconstructing the history of Ukraine as an independent history, emancipating from, let's say, Russian reconstruction of this history. And made him a kind of like a father of Ukraine, and so given it its own history. And probably you need something like that when you create yourself as a nation. And if you look at from that perspective, from the Netherlands, we don't have an historian anymore like that. So I refer to Lou de Jong as the...
But nobody has.
Well,
nowadays nobody has. It's because the figure like Hrushevsky now is impossible.
No, exactly what you say. Right? So, but if you look at a bit, if I think about, well, you know it much better than I. The place of history in Ukrainian current society is much more like looking for foundational stories who create your identity as a nation, and it's completely understandable to look for that. And I think if you look at the Netherlands, for instance, that this way of looking at history is not relevant anymore, so to say. You could say you are more or less emancipating for that.
Being post-industrial, post-materialism is also
post-historical. In a certain sense. Post-memory,
so to say.
Yes, but
post-historical memory.
Yeah, but it doesn't mean that there is that study of history is not relevant in that sense anymore. Of course, there's a lot of study of history.
Yeah. Losing relevance.
Relevance in the sense that giving an answer to who are we and who should we be. So you could say in that sense that the relationship becoming a nation on an historical basis, so to say, you could say, well, you are not a nation anymore that refers to a foundational historical stories.
But you are not post-national, or are you?
No.
You're still very national.
Yes. So what it is if you think about this national, you could say that this where history and nationality come in has something to do if you can differentiate between history and ethnic, becoming ethnic national. And in that sense, history has a very specific sense, I think. It relates you to a background of where are we coming from.
Which you described it because you are being post becoming less ethnic, more civic.
Yes, so that's very interesting because you're less ethnic and more civic. I agree with that. And this more civic is very interesting. And what we are.
I go back to Don Soba and then we'll be waiting for your call.
So and this more civic something. I agree with that. And you could say that we are now, let's say, facing today even this possibility in going two ways. So you see, if we're talking about migration in the Netherlands and the uneasiness and the anxiousness in the Netherlands about what kind of nation do we want to be, that there is the temptation to stress this ethnic again. So it's like a regression. You're becoming more ethnic. It's something in vain because there is not something there. But
if I may have time for a minute, would you describe some attitude of the Afro-Dutch or Afro-Netherlands? They will also see themselves as being threatened by this migration or not?
Ah, the Afro-Dutch. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Because it's also the issue: is it really ethnic or civic? Because if they feel themselves ethnic, or they feel themselves civic.
Yeah, that is a good question because I think what we are seeing now—that's a very complicated thing. So you see it in not only in Afro-Dutch, but also in Moroccan Dutch and Turkish Dutch, that there is, if I might say so, there is something like this looking for a foundational story which creates your identity as becoming Afro-Dutch. So you're looking for that. And this is a bit of like risky to say, but I think there's something to be said that you create yourself as a victim. As a victim.
Victim.
Yes. So being a victim is kind of creating your identity as Afro-Dutch. And being a victim creates your identity as Moroccan Dutch. Because you are a victim of the white man's burden. You have the burden. So that's a kind of a version of this ethnic. So this is very complicated. So I first recognized it because we had, I think about 20 years or even longer ago, we had a very interesting incident about a piece of Fassbinder. It's called I don't know in English.
has been the director.
He has been the director and the writer. It was he wrote it. Yes, that Fassbinder. In Dutch, it is called the vuil, the stad, and the dood. The mule, the city, and the death.
Say it again.
The mule, the vuil, the stad, the city, and the death, the dood. And there was quite a fuss of it because he was basically destructing something like Jewish identity in that. And as a German, this is of course very, very challenging to do that. And then it should be performed in the Netherlands, and it was Theo van Doesburger, the Dutch director, who wanted to do that. And there was a lot of discussion and protest that it couldn't be performed in the Netherlands. And in the end, it wasn't. So, but then there was a Jewish rabbi who wrote a piece in a newspaper, and he said, yeah, but you have to understand it very clearly, what it does, and it deconstructs the being a Jew as a victim. And doing that, you rob Jews in the Netherlands from, and not only in the Netherlands, for something that constructs their identity. So, and this is, I kept thinking about this. So I think it's very delicate, so to say, to think about it, because they were victims. So, and this is the same about the African Dutch. They were victims of slavery. The same about Moroccan Dutch. They are victims of discrimination. But there is really something very disturbing in constructing yourself as a victim, as part of your identity. And even if you look into the ethnic regression part, what you see now in the Netherlands as a temptation, closing borders, all that kind, is also thinking about yourself as a victim. So we are now, that's very complicated and very challenging to think, because we have two ways out of it. The first, and that is not really a way out, but that is like this ethnic part. And the other way out is like developing new kinds of citizenship, not only as an ethnic and as a civic nationalism, but as a cosmopolitan nationalism. And that's for us, this was at stake in the referendum. So, and the cosmopolitan form of nationalism means not stopping to be civic and not stopping to be ethnic, but adding something new to it. That as a civic nationalism, citizens of my nation, do I have some obligation to other citizens in the world who don't have the rights to become a citizen in the full sense that we have. And if I take up the rights on me...
But you are an epitome of this school. So how you call it again? Say it again, global?
Cosmopolitan.
Cosmopolitan. You are a cosmopolitan nationalist, I might say so. Because you come here, yes. This is kind of duty for the global world.
You're right.
But it's like I never heard this kind of phenomenon. It has been described somehow, conceptualized? Cosmopolitan nationalism?
Not yet. It is basically something what Franz and I was... And really, Franz deserves a lot of this, because really, he's really thinking about this, a lot of things. So.
But your society, being rich, and I would say happy, has a tremendous assimilation potential to assimilate the people who are coming in. And basically, you have a success story assimilation.
Well, that's basically this. I always think about, if you are a historian and you are writing history about the Netherlands in about 2250, as you're looking back 250 years, you would perceive something very strange in a certain sense. I think you would be, let's say, puzzled by why are these people making so a fuss about migration. And because they are so successful in it, and they think they are not successful. So again, so we...
Successful in terms of assimilation or not? Assimilation.
Now, assimilation is basically a wrong word, of course, I think in that sense. But successful in a sense that, we are a nation, we have what we talked about, African Dutch, we have Moroccan Dutch, and the most of them are doing rather well in the Netherlands. So, of course, we have our, when you could think about
it. But it's much better, I would say, than in France.
Yes, better than in Belgium. So, one of the, I'm working...
At least you don't have a tourist attack.
Exactly. So, I work a lot in Belgium, and we have talking about already for years because they're conceptualizing this as and practicing this laïcité, banishing religion from the public sphere, you are not allowed to wear a scarf at school, as a Muslim girl, and that's very humiliating if religion is so important for you. You know that as we're living in a very religious country. Let's say something to people here in the street, you're not allowed to practice your religion in the school anymore. So you will easily understand, this is totally nuts. I am. Religion is not like a coat you put on and you put off. Religion constitutes your identity again. And if you do that in your country, like the French and the Belgians, so we had a lot of discussion with that in Antwerp, but they did the same thing. For understandable reasons, but doing the wrong practice, you are basically creating humiliating practices for people who are deeply religious. And then if you do that, you create something like a society in your society, mm-hmm. what you don't want to have anything to do with.
Because it's a segregation in effect.
Exactly. This is like a kind of apartheid, what you're mm-hmm. introducing, a mental apartheid, so mm-hmm. to say. And that's not the way it works in the Netherlands, and not the way it works in not only in Denmark or what in Germany, basically, but not in the Netherlands. That don't mean that you don't have your problems, but a lot of problems are in the open. So and you can discuss on them, you can fight on them, you can because we have a lot of heated discussions between. Muslims and Dutch and whatever and so and we have also this temptation in Dutch society, like our right wing parties, who say, well, we want to ban Muslim from the public sphere and so on, and that's totally and because they think about Islamization of the Netherlands, which is totally idiot idea. That won't happen. We won't become a religious country again. Of course, that's not true. That's not happening. So we have this. You call Michel Hulenbeck, who writes in France about fantasizing France in 2015 under Muslim regime. And such a book couldn't have been written in the Netherlands. This would be totally not... it would be like... you could say that there's a kind of anti-European story.
I think that Oksana Zabushko recently claimed herself that he is a Ukrainian... named the author, I forgot, the French author.
Hulenbeck,
yeah, I forgot the name. His name escapes me. She recently claimed that she's a Ukrainian Hulenbeck, for particular reasons.
It is so that I can understand it, because Hulenbeck is like thinking the unthinkable, like so say, and she is doing a lot of his bit history and memories and like.
But also, I find this kind of writing some kind of dangerous, because it provides kind of otherness. It's other about othering. It's xenophobic.
Yeah. In a certain sense, it is, and. I think it is also very strange. This is, if you think about like this postmodern, so that I very much liked my discovery of Engelhardt, and then years ago when I discovered this map, and I say, okay, we are the most postmodern country in the world, together with not French, not the United States. No, we are, and their postmodern is like say. A kind of an interesting and very intelligent, you can't deny that, way of thinking their society. But for our society, it's not very relevant in that sense, so to say.
But is there a danger in a kind that having this kind of high-level secularization, being kind of post-identity, post-historical, that you may lose or already losing solidarity? Social solidarity.
This is an interesting question, because we have this discussion in the Netherlands about reconstruction of our welfare state, for instance, and one of the critiques of the welfare state and the underlying individualization. So that's one of the themes, is that it robs us of solidarity, and this is. Basically, if you look at the sociological surveys about solidarity in the Netherlands, they prove that it's not true.
infrastructure.
No, there's still a lot of people who do voluntary work. We are still very much involved in all kinds of solidarities and helpful things for others, not only in the Netherlands, but also outside the Netherlands. So I'm very doubtful, and I doubt very much the idea that it deconstructs our solidarity.
But then, as a Ukrainian, I'm bound to ask you that we were much expecting Ukrainians solidarity from you, but we didn't get it.
You mean in the referendum?
The referendum, yes. Yeah, yeah. What happened then? Well, you describe society which is benevolent, which is happy, thing like that, and quite of a sudden, just could say yeah, no to Ukraine.
Yeah, that's I would say, if I think about solidarity, that is how we, inherit in the Christian value of Caritas. And I think this
Caritas.
Caritas, nastily, next to Liebe. And I think this is still very vivid in society. So I think the referendum is a totally different thing. So basically, the referendum is a right-wing exploitation of anxiousness in the society. So the referendum started by this association. It's called Geen Stijl. Geen Pijl, as an anti-establishment, anti-European, anti-EU, movement, who wants basically this work on this ethnic national alternative. I think that's in some sense fair to say it. We create sovereignty, we have to decide for ourselves as a nation and that kind of things. So and they see the European Union as a threat to that. When they started their cause for the referendum, they almost by incident choose Ukraine as the.
I know.
In a very short answer to your question, if you could say, was the referendum about solidarity with Ukraine? No, not at all. The referendum was not about Ukraine.
Yeah, that I understand. But again, you could turn this question the way around, but it's about the European solidarity, which is also missing.
Well, in that sense, this is totally strange, huh? Because if you look...
Solidarity is still there. The issue of solidarity is still there.
Yeah.
Because Ukraine and Europeans is there, it's about solidarity.
Yeah, but if you look at it, that's strange, because when we were discussing the outcome in Parliament, the outcome of the referendum, this was very complicated, but there was a sort of a common agreement that the association agreement and the outcome of the referendum shouldn't mean that we left Ukrainians alone. No, we basically should support Ukraine and still keep support Ukraine. So this is a sort of solidarity correction about on the outcome of the referendum. If you look at European, it's a bit more complicated, but if you look at European and the EU policy to Ukraine, what you can see there is a consistently policy of supporting Ukraine. That doesn't stop.
We appreciate it.
Huh?
We see it and we appreciate it.
Yeah. So this is the referendum says a lot about the Netherlands.
So what do you say? What do you find that, if I may wrap up somehow, that becoming more post, you're not less solidar.
Exactly.
You're still solidar.
Yes.
That is still there.
Yeah.
So take another form.
It takes other forms. It takes different forms. But the strange thing is because. What I tell you about the welfare state and the discussion about the welfare state, and we're now talking about what we call a participating society, and all kind of a lot of fuss about that. And there was this inquiries, scientific inquiries. This did solidarity in the Netherlands decrease in the last decades? And the answer is simply no. It doesn't. It takes. You could put it another way. If I think about what basically this is, this secularization did, this emancipation of, as a form of emancipation of individuals in the Netherlands, you could also, what it did is basically created more independent individuals, like discovering the rights of children, for instance. So it took us till 1989 in the
United States. The rights of animals as well, probably.
The rights of animals. So what it does is basically the other way around. It creates a kind of a sensibility for the rights of every individual. And if you have even children, women, so that we were rather recently that we discover women rights and gay and lesbian rights and all these kind of things. So what it actually does, this not only secularization, but also the individualization, the deconstructing of the traditional moral narrative, you could say that, is the discovering of the individual rights of the individual. And the total amount of individual increased immensely. An individual thinking, not thinking as others who have rights on their own, so to say. That's what it is, does, and that's part of the anxiousness in the society, that if you have so many individuals with so many individual rights, so many difficult choices to make in lives, in schools, in hospitals, it means that you can violate so many rights of individuals. And that explains a bit, I like, the moral anxiousness of people who are working in hospitals or whatever, and their moral stress, so to say. We are a country with a lot of moral stress. That means that you have the sensibility that you have so much obligation to all who are involved in your daily lives. And that doesn't mean that solidarity decreases, that solidarity increases, because it means taking up.
Interestingly, you are saying against or counter Kolakowski to this. Because Kolakowski basically says, you know this famous book or essay about Jesus Christ, also his book about whether God would not exist. Mm-hmm. Because basically says that the answer is, if God doesn't exist, it's bound to exist. Because without the God, you couldn't build solidarity.
Yep.
Because otherwise solidarity will be evaporating, erasing.
Yep.
So that doesn't hold true in the case of Netherlands.
Well, you could say it another way. I would say that if God doesn't exist, moral judgment should exist. So what it means that if God doesn't exist and doesn't guide our daily decisions in that sense, we discover that we have to do something different. We have to judge for our own what we owe to the other. And that's moral judgment. And I think making your own moral judgment by doing right to the other. And I think that is basically what we are discovering and experimenting. I'm not saying that we have already created that in the sense of our society, so to say, in the broader sense. But that discovery, that we are, let's say, all individual moral learners, learning to judge for yourself in moral issues, so to say. And that doesn't mean following the prescription of God or whoever, not the prescription of the state, not the prescriptions of whatever. But that you have to make to judge on your own, and that you can be, how do you say, you have to make yourself fit for doing that. And that's what is the replacement. So if God doesn't exist, it doesn't mean that you the next time you should think about it, but he should exist. No, if God doesn't exist, moral judgment should exist. That's basically the.
So, and this would be based for a new solidarity, social solidarity.
Yes, I think so. So,
again, I'm finishing where we started. You are man of two worlds, at least, being here and there. Would you see that Netherlands is a kind of the mirror of the future for Ukraine, or just cultural differences that different that you could not say this word like one way? You see Netherlands as a future for other societies?
Well, as I see it, I don't see Netherlands as the future of other societies. I see the Netherlands as, in that sense, as a unique laboratory in the world, where, in a very special way, the outcomes of modernization are, let's say, confronted, discussed, and so on. So, in a certain sense, we don't know where we come out. So that you could put it another way around: is the Ukraine a future for the Netherlands?
Yes, exactly. Also, but what Ukraine? Exactly, what kind of Ukraine?
Yeah.
Nowadays, Ukraine or Ukraine 10 years ago, because there are a variety of Ukraines.
Yes, Ukraine, in a sense, you could say, well, there is a sort of special bond created between Ukraine and the Netherlands in the last decade, so to say. And for me, this started becoming here, but in a broader sense, you could say it started not only for the Netherlands, but the European champion football was one of the things that Ukraine became something special. And then you got, of course, you got Maidan, but made Ukraine something to look at for the Netherlands. And then you got, of course, MH17, but connected.
But what was important by Maidan, the people discussing then, this kind of the unbelievable, immense feeling of solidarity which was there.
Yeah.
Which is something which quite of outstanding, I would say, for nowadays world.
Yeah, I agree with that. And then you get MH17, and then we get the referendum. So we have a special bond with Ukraine. And from the first beginning, I thought when I saw Maidan, I'd say, okay, with France, I'd say, okay, Ukraine is teaching Europe a lesson. Or you could also say Ukraine is teaching Netherlands a lesson. And that has to do with this invention of this difference between being civic nationalism and this cosmopolitan nationalism. And so what Ukraine confronted the Netherlands with, it was, and my co-citizens with, is the question, what do I owe to you as a Ukrainian? And what does it mean to be a European? So the European Union was for us a gift. We have never have done and never have to fight for it. And you, as Ukrainians, you not only, that would be an overestimating of it, but you fought for being a European, so to say. You choose to be one. And by choosing, you became one. And that is for the Netherlands adding something for the citizens to say, okay, but if they... how do I respond to that? And it could help us to overcome this temptation of becoming ethnic nationalistic. And it could help us to make the step to being a cosmopolitan nationalist, so to say. So is the Netherlands the future of Ukraine? Yes, in a certain sense, because this discovery of this judging for yourself, immoral question is, let's say, the future for everyone in the world, and we have the let's say the privilege, let's say, as Dutch, not by choose, by choice, but because we are what we are, to experiment, to learn by that what it means for our society and our institutions. But Ukraine is the future of the Netherlands because it helps us to overcome this temptation of being national and ethnic national. To think about us ourselves in terms of what our obligations to our co-citizens in the rest of the world.
Thank you.
Thank you,
John. So if you permit me, I will put it on the website.
I would love to. I found it very interesting.
Thank you so much. You're very helpful. And I'll thank you again for what you're doing. Thank you. I bet.